gentleness.
That's notes from the Left Forum this week on the WBAI Evening News at 6 p.m. Tune in.
On Thursday, June 8th, from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m., Pacifica Radio will provide 3 hours of gavel-to-gavel analysis of former FBI Director James Comey's testimony before the United States Senate Intelligence Committee. The coverage will be produced by Pacifica's Washington, D.C. station, WPFW, with contributors from WBAI in New York, KPFA in Berkeley, and KPFK in Los Angeles. Immediately following the committee hearings, there will be commentary and analysis by experts in the area, many unlikely to be featured in mainstream media coverage of the hearing. Listeners may tune in to WBAI 99.5 FM on Thursday, June 8th, starting at 10 a.m. until 1 p.m. Pacifica Radio coverage of the Comey testimony. On Thursday, June 8th, from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m., Pacifica Radio will provide 3 hours of gavel-to-gavel analysis of former FBI.
When you think of the golden age of radio, you're bound to remember the performer whose hold on the heartstrings of America spanned almost 3 generations.
Well, thank you, Jack. Yes, it's Max Schmid, and I'm your host for the Golden Age of Radio. Sunday nights at 7 p.m. here on WBAI, presenting the finest in radio's history, comedy, drama, mysteries, science fiction. Won't you join me Sunday nights at 7 for the Golden Age of Radio? Only here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM.
I hope you feel.
Like many of you, like many Americans, I have felt frustrated and betrayed by the state of the mainstream media in this country. A media whose priorities seem out of step with their responsibilities. We need a media that strengthens democracy, not a media that strengthens the government. We need a media that enriches public discourse, not one that enriches corporations.
Hi, I'm Jane Fonda, and this is WBAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio in New York.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, imagination, and enchantment. My name is Jim Freund, Did you miss us? Okay, a lot of catching up this morning. Some movie reviews, talking about attending the Nebula Awards, some remarks about new media, and listening to one of this year's Nebula Award short story finalists. Stay tuned.
Come take a trip in my airship. I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. What can you say about a film that is as undemanding as Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2? It wants you to have a good time, and you do. If you love the first film, which I did, you're going to have a ball with this next chapter. That's not an inconsiderable achievement. Lots of films want to be fun and just don't cut it. I think it says something to this cast's particular alchemy. They're all back, by the way. Chris Pratt, Zoe Saldana, Dave Bautista, Karen Gillan, Michael Rooker, Bradley Cooper, and Vin Diesel doing voice work, the whole bit. It also says something to James Gunn's skills and intelligence as writer and director in bringing depth to these comic book characters and in balancing comedy, drama, and CG Marvel movie spectacle, that these films give you license for letting go and having fun without feeling that you've indulged in the intellectual equivalent of eating an entire box of marshmallow peeps in one sitting. I will say this, in reviewing the first Guardians, I admitted to some confusion over the family ties depicted in the film. There were sisters and surrogate fathers and impromptu family connections being formed. My thought then was that it was a bit of minor sloppiness in the writing, probably having to do with syncing the film up with the Marvel franchise as it existed in comics at the time. Now, I'm not so sure. The big thing in Volume 2 is the revelation of Peter Quill's, aka Star-Lord's, real father, who turns out to be a sentient planet who for a hobby has taken the form of Kurt Russell. This means that Quill, still played with amiable doofiness by Chris Pratt, now has something on the order of three real and surrogate fathers, four if you want to count David Hasselhoff, and who wouldn't, plus the funky bunch that forms his Guardians family and whose structure here is rejiggered a little bit to incorporate some romance and a sibling reconciliation. As I noted in my previous review, one of the kinkier ideas of Guardians is that while we Earthlings are going on with our drab, constrained little lives, all sorts of madness is going on elsewhere in the universe. And I'm beginning to think that Gunn is suggesting that part of that chaos is the notion of family. I, in having rejected the concept of an active organizing intelligence to the universe, take comfort in the idea that we all originally stemmed from the same source. We, along with every particle in existence, were all literally one at the beginning. And I think in depicting the chaos of relations in Guardians, Gunn is trying to point out how narrow our, and by our I mean us Americans, conventional view of the family is. We are still all one in the end, and still one with the universe. There is, of course, also the fact that mainstream films frequently play the it's all about family card in order to give themselves an emotional gravity they otherwise don't really deserve. Gunn may be paying lip service to that, but I think he's also pushing beyond it to something more intriguing and definitely more welcome. Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 doesn't lean heavily on the concept, but it is something that pushes this joyously tumultuous movie past just being amusing eye candy. The main character in the Russian film, The Student, doesn't have time for amusements. A budding teen sociopath, he's landed on his own read of fundamentalist Christianity, and over the course of the film deploys Bible quotes and his own charismatic will to sow chaos among befuddled educators, amused classmates, and a disabled and idolizing acolyte. There is an unanticipated relevance in watching a malignant personality blithely run over the social contract for his own ends, but beyond that, director and co-writer Kirill Serebrennikov deploys his star Pyotr Skvortsov in a fantastic performance to both take down the hypocrisies of religious fervor and explore how, against a truly toxic intelligence, good intentions sometimes aren't enough. I look at The Student as a kind of mirror universe rendition of Lindsay Anderson's If, where anarchy leads not to freedom but to the destruction of basic humanity. It's a fantastic drama and a stern warning. The horror film Rupture also plays with the definition of humanity, Although here it's about a woman with an uncontrollable fear of spiders, played by Noomi Rapace, being kidnapped and taken to a facility where victims are being exposed to their fears in order to push them to the next stage of human evolution. That the next stage looks like a troll doll being unevenly inflated from the inside is one incongruity in a film that appears to be trying to say something about the dangers of moving past the frailties that make us human, but that, with its grotty torture chambers and sickly yellow cinematography, winds up looking like a slightly brainier version of Saw. The writer and director, Steven Sheinberg, who previously cleverly mapped out the intersection between love, the workplace, and BDSM in Secretary, appears to have intended this as the first chapter of a franchise. But since Rupture has been sitting on the shelf since 2015, that's probably not going to be happening, which may be a good thing. Sheinberg may have been trying to explore our natures for good or ill, but the trappings of the horror film prove to be too much of a distraction. For Hour of the Wolf, I'm Dan Persons.
I've got to say that I thought the best thing in Guardians of the Galaxy 2 was the soundtrack, especially some brilliant use of Fleetwood Mac. This is Hour of the Wolf over listener-sponsored WBAI in New York City, non-commercial Pacifica radio broadcasting at 99.5 FM. And, well, it's been 5 weeks since I have last been on the air, and that was a pitching shift, as a matter of fact, raising money because, well, as I said, listener-sponsored radio. So we are way, way behind on, well, talking about science fiction and things like that. But, or rather, therefore, I thought that I would spend this morning with a potpourri of materials. Let's see, I actually wrote a little thing for our copy, saying that, among other things, I would discuss my trip to Pittsburgh, which I will do shortly, and also going to talk a lot about recent science fiction and media, including Wonder Woman. I've got a 3-word review. Don't miss it. Fargo, the TV series, which is coming to a bizarre, amazing close. The current season of Doctor Who, we're about halfway through it. Class, which just finished. And Legion, which is Noah Hawley, same person, who is responsible for the television renditions of Fargo, and I wanted to talk a little bit about American Gods and its relationship to the current cable and streaming versions of science fiction, including The Man in the High Castle, but American Gods being one of my favorite novels, I thought would be something worth discussing. Okay, let's talk about my trip to Pittsburgh. Why not? How is that relevant? Well, because that's where the Nebula Awards were held about 2.5 weeks ago. And I've often attended the Nebula Awards when they are in, stone's throw distance. A few years ago, I went the 2 years that they were being held in Washington, D.C., and of course I always attend whenever they are in New York City. But of particular primary importance was the fact that my partner, writer Barbara Krasnoff, was a finalist for the first time for a Nebula Award for her short story, Sabbath Wine. And this is, you know, something that is just a thrill beyond belief. You know, when they say it's an honor just to be nominated, that is true. And the fact that when you hear what the short stories were that were nominated, and then you will begin to understand. There was, okay, I've got to actually click on it to get the whole title, because it's a long, long title. I should know it by heart, because I worked on the podcast version of this story for Lightspeed Magazine. And it's by Carolyn M. Yoakum. That is spelled Y-O-A-C-H-I-M. I am so sorry I did not get a chance to introduce myself to her at the event. But welcome to the medical clinic at the Interplanetary Relay Station. Hours since the last patient death, zero. It's an amazing story. I really enjoyed doing the audio editing on that. Brooke Bolander, a wonderful, brilliant, great writer, whom you will hardly have heard the last of. Our talons can crush galaxies. Things with Beards, by a person with a beard, Sam J. Miller, who, as a matter of fact, was one of our two readers last night at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings here at 388 Atlantic Avenue, where he read with Lara Elena Donnelly and Barbara Krasnoff, of course, is our house manager. She's the person at the door. So we had two of the nominees right there. This Is Not a Wardrobe Door, by A. Merck Rustad, who is a fascinating writer. I have gotten, I am not sure how to use pronouns for Merck, because Merck is, what is the word, neutois? You know, not doesn't identify male or female specifically, but a neutral gender. A lovely person and a great writer, regardless of all that. And then A Fist in Permutations in Lightning and Wildflowers, by Alyssa Wong, who for whom it is impossible not to be nominated because she is that good. And then Sabbath Wine, by Barbara Krasnoff. And, you know, so there were seven stories this year. Usually there were five. For various reasons, there were seven. And let me tell you something. If any one of those, any one of those, had won the award, they would have deserved it. It's that simple. It's that good. I don't know what the spread in the votes were. I can tell you that Seasons of Glass and Iron, by Amal El-Motar, was the winner. And, you know, that's one of the few stories, actually, that I haven't read. I've read a lot of other work of hers. But I have to catch up on that. That's also nominated this year for the Hugo Award. So best of luck to her on that, and congratulations to her on winning that. I did get to talk to Amal at length. I met her at a ReaderCon a couple of years ago, and as a singer. I did not know that this person doing these absolutely wonderful Appalachian versions of a lot of the Steel Eye Span songs, you know, like Lord Donald, well, that's not Steel Eye Span as much as Fairport Convention, but the child ballads, doing those with a fabulous voice, was also this incredible, wonderful science fiction writer. So we drove to Pittsburgh, which is actually a very pleasant drive. The last time I was in Pittsburgh was for a series of science fiction conventions in the late 70s called Flange, spelled P-G-H-L-A-N-G-E, P-G-H, of course, for Pittsburgh. And thank God the city has changed. You can breathe there now. You didn't used to be able to, and it was frankly an ugly, ugly place, and it is that no longer. On the other hand, I found myself not overly impressed with what I saw of the city, but what I saw of the city was extremely limited. It would be like trying to describe New York and saying, my God, it's just gaudy and noisy and loud and this and that, because all you get to see is Times Square, because we were right in the heart of the city. And had I not been with a nominee, with one of the finalists, perhaps we would have had more free time. I was talking yesterday to Lara Elena Donnelly, and whose book, by the way, Amber Lowe, is now out. I hope you heard her on the show a couple of months ago. And and by the way, you can watch last night's reading at... well, the easiest thing to do is go to Facebook, or go to, yeah, not if you go to my webpage. I haven't posted it yet, but I will. But if you go to livestream.com and search for NYRSF, NYRSF, the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, you will find, well, many readings that we have done there, and you will catch last night's reading with Lara and Sam J. Miller, and you'll see Barbara as well. But at any rate, well, I managed to totally digress myself. Pittsburgh itself was not for me the highlight. It was being there with my partner, actually being a nominee. Now, the language is changing. They are no longer just nominees, and I really like this idea. Because on Friday, for example, or Saturday afternoon, you're a nominee. You're one of the people who's been nominated for the Nebula Award. But now they're starting to change that language, that you are instead a finalist. They're doing this with the Hugos as well. In fact, I think the Hugos, which is a fan award, where the Nebula is a peer award given out by members of Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America, whereas the Hugo, controversially, anybody who pays at least a supporting membership can vote on the Hugos. If you're a finalist after the award ceremony, you are still a finalist. So you can't say that Barbara is a nominee for Best Short Story this year, because that's done with. That's over. But she's still a finalist. She will always be a finalist for the 2017 Nebula Award. And that's like a title. That's a really cool thing to be able to say. And the short story that she wrote, Sabbath Wine, well, frankly, is top-notch. That's one that you can find on YouTube. In fact, if you go to, I guess it's my channel on YouTube, Jim Freund, and I have a channel with all of two things on there. Eventually, I will populate it with a great deal of stuff. But one of the things that I put there so that Barbara could, I won't say campaign, but make people aware of the short story and the performance that she did, was to post that story. She read on January 2nd of 2016, last year, and it went well. She read, I would say, 80% of the story. And then the following April, when we did the Clockwork Phoenix 5 reading, which is also online, she read the missing 20%. So you can, between the two, you can get the whole thing. But better yet, go to her website, brooklynwriter.com, and you will see a link to several of her short stories, including reading the text. Whoops, pardon me, hitting the microphone here. Reading the text of the story, or for that matter, watching her read it. But you know what we're going to do now is we are going to listen to her read that short story, and then we'll be back with those other topics. This runs just shy of 40 minutes. I think that we are pretty good in terms of the language. If there is any cursing in there, it's in Yiddish. It ain't in English, okay? So we ought to be just fine. But it's an affecting story and a funny story at the same time. And I hope you enjoy it. And, well, here's me introducing her.
Has sold over 30 pieces of short fiction to a wide variety of publications. Anthologies include Memories and Visions,
Women's
Fantasy and Science Fiction, Such a Pretty Face, Clockwork Phoenix 2, 4, and 5, Broken Time Blues, Fantastic Tales in the Roaring Twenties. She sells these books with long, long subtitles. It seems to be a specialty. Here's another. Subversion, Science Fiction and Fantasy, Tales of Challenging the Norm. Which of those words get capitalized and which don't are up to the whim of Bart Lieb and Kay Holt. Outside of that, I've never quite figured it all out. That comes later. Menial, Skilled Labor in Science Fiction. Fat Girl in a Strange Land. Her stories have also appeared in publications Amazing Stories, Lady Churchill's Rosebud Wristlet, Descant, Weird Tales, Sybil's Garage, Escape Velocity, Behind the Wainscot, thank you. That's why I'm on the radio. Doorways, Apex, Electric Velocipede, Space and Time, Crossed Genres, Atomic Avarice, there's a great name, Cosmos, Voluted Tales, Triptych Tales, and Perihelion. Most recently, her story, With Triumph Under Her House, has just appeared in Abyss and Apex, and she will have stories in Clockwork Phoenix 5, which you're about to hear, and a future issue of Mystic Delirium. It is mythic. How did I write mystic? I thought you were supposed to proofread this. Anyway,
I should mention, by the way, that just went online. It's called The Ladderback Chair.
Also the author of a YA nonfiction book, Robots Real, R-E-E-L, to Real, R-E-A-L. She is currently the senior reviews editor for Computer World. She is a member of the New York City writers group, Tabula Rasa, as is Richard Bose, our second reader. And she lives in Brooklyn, New York, which Rick does not. Her website is brooklynwriter.com. So please welcome Barbara Krasnoff.
Okay, is this is good.
That's okay. This is better.
This is better. Okay.
I'll bring you water.
All right. This story is appearing, as he said, in Clockwork Phoenix 5. It's a little long, so what I've cut out one small portion of it, and I will stop at that point, tell you what happens, and go on. And it is called Sabbath Wine. "My name's Malka Hirsch," said the girl. "I'm 9. "I'm David Richards," the boy said. "I'm almost 13. The two kids were sitting on the bottom step of a rundown brownstone at the edge of the Brooklyn neighborhood of Brownsville. It was late on a hot summer afternoon, and people were just starting to drift home from work, lingering on stoops and fire escapes to catch any hint of a breeze before going up to their stifling flats. Malka and David had been sitting there companionably for a while, listening to a chorus of gospel singers practicing in the first floor front apartment at the top of the stairs. Occasionally, the music paused as a male voice offered instructions and encouragement. It was during one of those pauses that the kids introduced themselves to each other. Malka looked up at her new friend doubtfully. "You don't mind talking to me?" she asked. "Most big boys don't like talking to girls my age. My cousin Shlomo? He only wanted to talk to the older girl who lived down the street and who wore short skirts and a scarf around her neck." "I don't mind," said David. "I like kids. And anyway, I'm dead, so I guess that makes a difference." Above them, the enthusiastic chorus started again. As a soprano wailed a high lament, she shivered in delight. "I wish I could sing like that." "It's called Right Up in the Chariot," said David. "When I was little, my mama used to sing it when she washed the white folks' laundry. She told me my great-grandma sang it when she stole away from slavery." "It's nice," Malka said. She had short, dark brown hair that just reached her shoulders and straight bangs that touched her eyebrows. She had pulled her rather dirty knees up and was resting her chin on them, her arms wrapped around her legs. "I've heard that one before, but I didn't know what it was called. They practice every Thursday, and I come here to listen." "Why don't you go in?" asked David. He was just at that stage of adolescence where the body seems to be growing too fast, his long legs stretched out in front of him while he leaned back on his elbows. He had a thin, cheerful face set off by bright, intelligent eyes, and hair cropped so close to his skull that it looked almost painted on. "I'm sure they wouldn't mind, and you could hear better." Malka grinned and pointed to the sign just above the front door bell that read, "Cornerstone Baptist Church." "My papa would mind," she said. "He'd mind plenty. He'd think I was going to get converted or something." "No wonder I never seen you before," said the boy. "I usually just come on Sundays. Other days I..." He paused. "Well, I usually just come on Sundays." The music continued against a background of voices from the people around them. A couple of floors above, a baby cried, and two men argued in sharp, dangerous tones. Down on the ground, a gang of boys ran past, laughing, ignoring the two kids sitting outside the brownstone. A man sat on a cart laden with what looked like a family's possessions. Obviously in no hurry, he let the horse take its time as it proceeded down the cobblestone street. The song ended, and a sudden clatter of chairs and conversation indicated that the rehearsal was over. The two kids stood and moved to a nearby street lamp so they wouldn't get in the way of the congregation leaving the brownstone in twos and threes. Malka looked at David. "Wait a minute," she said. "Did you say you were dead?" "Uh-huh," he said. "Well, at least that's what my daddy told me." She frowned. "You ain't," she said. And then when he didn't say anything, "Really?" He nodded affably. She reached out and poked him in the arm. "You ain't," she repeated. "If you were a ghost or something, I couldn't touch you." He shrugged and stared down at the street. Unwilling to lose her new friend, Malka quickly added, "It don't matter. If you want to be dead, that's okay with me." "I don't want to be dead," said David. "I don't even really know if I am. It's just what Daddy told me." "Okay," Malka said. She swung slowly around the pole, holding on with one hand. while David stood patiently, his hands in the pockets of his worn pants. Something caught his attention, and he grinned. "Bet I know what he's got under his coat," he said, and pointed at a tall man hurrying down the street, his jacket carefully covering a package. "It's a bottle," said Malka scornfully. "That's obvious." "It's moonshine," said David, laughing. "How do you know?" asked Malka, peering at the man. "My daddy sells the stuff," said David, "out of a candy store over on Dumont Street." Malka was impressed. "Is he a gangster? I saw a movie about a gangster once." David grinned again. "Nah," he said, "just a low-rent bootlegger. If my mama ever heard about it, she'd come back here and make him stop in a hurry, you bet." "My mama's dead," said Malka said. "Where is yours?" David shrugged. "Don't know," he said. "She left one day and never came back." He paused, then asked curiously, "You all don't go to church, do you?" "Nope." "Well, what do you do?" Malka smiled and tossed her hair back. "I'll show you," she said. "Would you like to come to a Sabbath dinner?" Malka and her father lived in the top floor of a modern five-story apartment building, about 6 blocks from the brownstone church. Somewhere between there and home, David had gone his own way. Malka didn't quite remember when. It didn't matter much, she decided. She had a plan, and she could tell David about it later. She stood in the main room that acted as parlor, dining room, and kitchen. It was sparsely but comfortably furnished. Besides a small wooden table that sat by the open window, there was a coal oven, a sink with cold running water, a cupboard over against one wall, and an overloaded bookcase against another. A faded flower print rug covered the floor. It had obviously seen several tenants come and go. Malka's father sat at the table reading a newspaper by the slowly waning light, his elbow on the windowsill, his head leaning on his hand. A small plate with the remains of his supper sat nearby. He hadn't shaved for a while. A short, dark beard covered his face. "Papa," said Malka. Her father winced as though something hurt him, but he didn't take his eyes from the book. "Yes, Malka," he asked. "Papa, today is Thursday, isn't it?" He raised his head and looked at her. Perhaps it was the beard, or perhaps he worked so hard at the furrier's where he spent his days curing animal pelts. But his face seemed more worn and sad than ever. "Yes, daughter," he said quietly. "Today is Thursday." She sat opposite him and folded her hands neatly in front of her. "Which means that tomorrow is Friday, and tomorrow night is the Sabbath." He smiled. "Now, Malka, when was the last time you saw your papa in a synagogue rocking and mumbling useless prayers with the old men? This isn't how I brought you up. You know I won't participate in any bourgeois religious ceremonies," she finished with him. "Yes, I know. But I was thinking, Papa, that I would like to have a real Sabbath, the kind that you used to have with Mama. Just once, as..." Her face brightened. "As an educational experience." Her father sighed and closed his book. "An educational experience, huh?" he asked. "I see. How about this? If you want, on Saturday, we can go to Prospect Park. We'll sit by the lake and feed the swans. Would you like that?" "That would be nice," said Malka. "But it's not the same thing, is it?" He shrugged. "No, Malka, you're right. It isn't." Across the alley, a clothesline squeaked as somebody pulled on it. An infant cried, and somebody cursed in a loud combination of Russian and Yiddish. "And what brought on this sudden religious fervor?" a father asked. "You're not going to start demanding I grow my beard to my knees and read nothing but holy books, are you?" "Oh, Papa," Malka said, exasperated. "Nothing like that. I made friends with this boy today named David. He's older than I am, over 12. And his father also doesn't approve of religion, but his mama used to sing the same songs they sing in the church down the street. We listened to them today, and I thought maybe I could invite him here and show him what we do." Her voice trailed off as she saw her father's face. "You were at a church?" her father asked a little tensely. "And you went in and listened?" "No, of course not. We sat outside. It's the church on the first floor of that house on Remsen Avenue. The one where they sing all those wonderful songs. Ah, her father said, enlightened, and shook his head. Well, and I shouldn't be pig-headed about this. Your mama always said I could be very pig-headed about my political convictions. You are a separate individual and deserve to make up your own mind. And it's really for educating David, said Malka eagerly. Her father smiled. Would that make you happy, Malka, he asked, to have a Sabbath dinner for you and your friend, just this once? Yes, just this once, she said, bouncing on her toes, with everything that goes with it. Of course, her father said. I did a little overtime this week. I can ask Sarah, who works over at the delicatessen, for a couple pieces chicken, a loaf of bread, and maybe some soup and noodles. And I know we have some candles put by. And you have Grandpa's old prayer book, she encouraged. Yes, I have that. So all we need is the wine, Malka said triumphantly. Her father's face fell. So all we need is the wine. He thought for a moment and then nodded. Moshe will know. He knows everybody in the neighborhood. If anyone has any wine to sell, he'll know about it. It's going to get dark soon, said Malka. Is it too late to ask? Her father smiled and stood. Not too late at all. He's probably in the park. So, Abe, Moshe said to Malka's father, frowning, you are going to betray your ideals and kowtow to the religious authorities? You, who were nearly sent to Siberia for writing articles linking religion to the consistent poverty of the masses? You, who were carried bodily out of your father's synagogue for refusing to wear a hat at your brother's wedding? Abe had immediately spotted Moshe, an older, slightly overweight man with thinning hair on the well-worn bench where he habitually spent each summer evening. But after trying to explain what he needed, only to be interrupted by Moshe's irritable rant, Abe finally shrugged and walked a few steps away. Malka followed. There are some boys playing baseball over there, he told her. Why don't you go and enjoy the game and let me talk to Moshe by myself? Okay, Papa, Malka said and ran off. Abe watched her for a moment and then looked around. The small city park was full of people, driven out of their apartments by the heat. Kids ran through screaming, taking advantage of the fact that their mothers were still cleaning up after dinner and therefore not looking out for misbehavior. Occasionally, one of the men who occupied the benches near the small plot of brown grass would stand and yell, Sammy, stop fighting with that boy. Then, content to have done his duty by his offspring, he would sit down and the kids would proceed as though nothing had happened. Abe walked back to the bench and sat next to his friend, who now sat disconsolately batting a newspaper against his knee. Moshe, just listen for a minute. But before he could finish, Moshe handed him his newspaper, climbed onto the bench, and pointed an accusing finger at a thin man who had just lit a cigarette two benches over. You, Moshe yelled. Harry, I have a bone to pick with you. What the hell were you doing writing that dreck about the Pennsylvania steel strike? How dare you use racialism to try to cover up the crimes of the AFL in subverting the strike? They were scabs, the little man yelled back, gesturing with his cigarette. The fact that they were Negroes is not an excuse. They were workers who were trying to feed their families in the face of overwhelming oppression, Moshe called back. If the AFL had any respect for the people they were trying to organize, they could have brought all the workers into the union and the bosses wouldn't have been able to break the strike. You ignore the social and cultural problems, yelled Harry. You ignore the fact that you're a schmuck, roared Moshe. Will you get down and act like a human being for once? Asked Abe, hitting his friend with the newspaper. I have a problem. Moshe shrugged and climbed down. At the other bench, Harry made an obscene gesture and went back to dourly sucking on his cigarette. Okay, I'm down, said Moshe. So tell me, what's your problem? Like I was saying, said Abe, I'm going to have a Sabbath meal. Moshe squinted at him. New? He asked. You got yourself a girlfriend finally? Abe shook his head irritably. No, I don't have a girlfriend. Too bad, his friend said, crossing his legs and surveying the park around him. You can only mourn so long, you know. A young man like you, he shouldn't be alone like some alter cocker like me. Abe smiled despite himself. No, I just... He looked for a moment to where Malka stood with a boy just a little taller than her, both watching the baseball game. That must be her new friend, he thought, probably from the next neighborhood over. His clothes seemed a bit too small for his growing frame. Abe wondered whether he had parents, and if so, whether they couldn't afford to dress their child properly. It's just this once, he finally said, a gift for a child. Okay, said Moshe, so what do you want from me? Absolution for abrogating your political ideals? His growing frame. Abe wondered whether he had parents, and if so, whether they couldn't afford to dress their child properly. It's just this once, he finally said, a gift for a child. Okay, said Moshe, so what do you want from me? Absolution for abrogating your political ideals? I want wine. Ah, Moshe turned and looked at Abe. I see. You've got the prayer book, you've got the candles, you've got the challah. But the alcohol, that's another thing. You couldn't have come up with this idea last year before the geniuses in Washington gave us prohibition. I want to do it right, said Abe. No grape juice and nothing made in someone's bathtub. And nothing illegal. I don't want to make the gangsters any richer than they are. Well, Mo shrugged, if you're going to make this an ethical issue, then I can't help. Oh, come on, Abe said impatiently. It's only been a few months since Prohibition went into effect. I'm sure somebody's got to have a few bottles of wine stashed away. I'm sure they do, Moshe said, but they're not going to give them to you. And don't look at me, he added quickly. What I got stashed away isn't what you drink at the Sabbath table. Hell, Abe stood and shook his head. I made a promise. You got a cigarette? Moshe handed him one, and then, as Abe lit a match, said, hey, why don't you go find a rabbi? Abe blew out some smoke. I said I wanted to make a Sabbath meal. I didn't say I wanted to attend services. Moshe laughed. No, I mean for your wine. When Congress passed prohibition, the rabbis and priests and other religious big shots, they put up a fuss. So now they get to buy a certain amount for their congregation. You want some booze? Go find the rabbi. Abe stared at him. You're joking, right? Moshe continued to grin. Truth. I heard it from a Hasidic friend of mine. We get together, play a little chess, argue. He told me that he had to go with his Reb to the authorities because the old man can't speak English, so they could sign the papers and prove he was a real rabbi. Now he's got the right to buy a few cases a year so the families can say a blessing on the Sabbath and get drunk on Passover. Abe nodded, amused. Figures. He thought for a moment. There's a shul over on Livonia Avenue where my friend's son had his bar mitzvah. Maybe I should try there. If you got a friend who goes there, Moshe suggested, why not simply get the wine from him? Abe took a long drag on his cigarette and shook his head. No, I don't want to get him in trouble with his rabbi. I'll go ask myself. Thanks, Moshe. Think nothing of it. Suddenly, Moshe's eyes narrowed, and he jumped up onto the bench again, yelling to a man entering the park, Joe, you capitalist son of a bitch! I saw that letter you wrote in the Daily Forward! Abe walked over to his daughter. You heard? He asked quietly. We'll go over to the synagogue right now and see what the rabbi can do for you. Yes, Papa, Malka said and added, This is David. He's my new friend that I told you about. David, this is my father. How do you do, Mr. Hirsch? Asked David politely. How do you do, David? Replied Abe. It's nice to meet you. I'm glad Malka has made a new friend. Mr. Hirsch, said David, you don't have to go to that rabbi if you don't want to. I heard my father say that he and his business partners got some Jewish wine that he bought from a rabbi who didn't need it all. And I'm sure he could sell you a bottle. Abe smiled. Thank you, David. But as I told my friend, I'd rather not get involved in something illegal. You understand, he added, I do not mean to insult your father. That's okay, David said. He turned and whispered to Malka, "You go ahead with your daddy. I'll go find mine. You come and get me if you need me for anything. He's usually at the candy store on the corner of Dumont and Saratoga." "Okay," Malka whispered back, "and if we do get wine, I'll come to get you, and you can come to our Sabbath dinner." Abe stared at the two children for a moment, then pulled the cigarette out of his mouth, tossed it away, and began walking. Malka waved at David and followed her father out of the park. At this point, they go to a synagogue, and of course the rabbi refuses to sell him any wine because he's a radical. So they decide to go and try David's father. Even from the outside, the candy store did not look promising, or even open. The windows were pasted over with ads, some of which were peeling off. When Malka and her father looked through the glass, shading their eyes with one hand, it was too dark inside to see much. "You stay out here," her father finally said. "This is not a place for little girls." He took a breath and pushed the door open. A tiny bell tinkled as he stepped through. Malka, too curious to obey, quietly went in after him and stood by the door, trying to make herself as small as possible. The store looked as unfriendly inside as it did out. A long counter, which had obviously once been used to serve sodas and ice cream, ran along the right wall of the store. It was empty and streaked with dust, and the shelves behind it were bare except for a few glasses. At the back of the store, there was a display case in which a few cans and dry-looking cakes sat. The rest of the small space was taken up by several round tables. Only one was occupied, and it was partially obscured by a haze of cigarette smoke. Malka squinted. Three men sat there, playing cards. One was short and fat, with the darkest skin Malka had ever seen. He scowled at the cards while a cigarette hung from the corner of his mouth. A second, much younger and slimmer, was carefully dressed in a brown dash, like it was always wet. The third man, she decided, must be David's father. He had David's long, thin face and slight build, but the humor that was always dancing in David's wide eyes had long ago disappeared from his. A long, pale scar ran from his left eye to the corner of his mouth, intensifying his look of a man who was not to be trifled with. As she watched, he reached into his pocket and pulled out a small flask. He took a pull and replaced it without taking his eyes off the cards. Malka's father waited for a moment or two and then cleared his throat. None of the three looked up. "I think you're in the wrong store, white man," the fat man said. Malka's father put his hands in his pockets. "I was told I could purchase a bottle or two of wine here." "You a Fed?" asked the man with the slick back hair. "Only a Fed would be stupid enough to walk in here by himself." "Ain't no Fed," the fat man said. "Listen to him. He's a Jew. Ain't no Fed Jews." "There's Izzy Einstein," said the man with the hair. "He arrested three guys in Coney just yesterday. I read it in the paper." "Too skinny to be Izzy Einstein," said the fat man. "Nah, he's just your everyday, ordinary white man who's looking to buy some cheap booze." "I was told I could buy wine here," repeated Malka's father calmly, although Malka could see his hands, which he kept in his pocket, were trembling. "I was told you had kosher wine." The man with the scar stood and came over as the other two watched. Now Malka could see that his suit was worn and not as clean as it could be. He walked slowly, carefully, as though he knew he wasn't sober and didn't want to give it away. When he reached Malka's father, he stopped and waited. He didn't acknowledge the boy who followed him solicitously, as though ready to catch his father should he fall. Malka grinned and waved. "Hi, David," she said, and then, aware that she might be calling attention to herself, whispered, "I didn't see you before." David put his finger to his lips and shook his head. "So," Malka's father asked, "you have wine for sale?" "My landlord is a Jew," said David's father, challenging. "So's mine. I'll bet they're both sons of bitches." There was a moment of silence. Malka held her breath. And then one corner of the man's mouth twitched. Okay, he said, maybe we can do business. His two colleagues relaxed. The man with the hair swept up the cards and began shuffling them. Where did you hear about me? Your son David here, said Malka's father. He suggested I contact you. My son David told you, the man repeated, his eyes narrowing. Yes, Malka's father said, sounding puzzled. Earlier today. Is there a problem? There was a pause, and then the man shook his head. No, no problem. Yeah, I got some of that kosher wine you were talking about. I can give you two bottles for $3 each. Malka's father took a breath. That's expensive. Those are the prices, the man shrugged. Hard to get specialized product these days. David stood on his toes and whispered up at his father. The man didn't look down at the boy, but bit his lip and then said, okay, I can give you the two bottles for $5. And that's because you come with a family recommendation. Done, said Malka's father. He put out his hand. Abe Hirsch. David's father took his hand. Sam Richards, he said. You want to pick your merchandise up in the morning? Abe shook his head. I've got to work early, he said. Can I pick it up after work? Done, Sam said. Malka's father turned and walked toward the door, then turned back. I apologize, he said, shaking his head. I am an idiot. David, your son, has been invited to my house for dinner tomorrow night, and I have not asked his father's permission. And of course, you are also invited as well. Sam stared at him. You invited my son to your house for dinner? Abe shrugged. Hey, Sam, called the well-dressed man. You can't go nowhere tomorrow night. We've got some business to take care of uptown at the Sugar Cane. Sam ignored his friend and looked at Malka, who stood next to her father, scratching an itch on her leg and grinning at the success of her plan. This your little girl? It was Abe's turn to stare. He looked down at Malka, who was nodding wildly, delighted at the idea of another guest at their Sabbath meal. He then looked back at Sam. Okay, said Sam. What time? Around 5 p.m., Abe said, and gave the address. We don't have to be uptown until 9, Sam said to his friend. Plenty of time. He turned back to Malka's father. Okay, I'll bring the wine with me. But you make sure you have the money. Just because you're feeding us dinner, don't mean the drinks come free. Of course, said Abe. At 5 p.m. the next evening, everything was ready. The table had been pulled away from the window and decorated with a white tablecloth from the same woman who'd sold Abe a boiled chicken and a carrot simmers. Settings for four, two extra chairs borrowed from the carpenter who lived across the hall, two candles, and at Abe's place, his father's old prayer book. Abe, wearing his good jacket despite the heat, and with a borrowed yarmulke perched on his head, surveyed the scene. Well, Malka, he asked, how does that look? It's perfect, said Malka, running from one end of the room to the other to admire the table from different perspectives. Almost on cue, somebody knocked on the door. It's David, Malka yelled. David, just a minute. I'm sure he heard you, Abe said, smiling. The super in the basement probably heard you. He walked over and opened the door. Sam stood there, a small suitcase in his hand. He had obviously made some effort toward improving his personal appearance. He was freshly shaven, wore a clean shirt, and had a spit polish on his shoes. David dashed out from behind his father. You see, he told Malka, everything worked out. My daddy brought the wine, like he said, and I made him dress up because I said it was going to be religious, and Mama would have let him come to church all messed up. Right, Daddy? You sure did, David, said Sam, smiling. Even maybe wash behind my ears. He then raised his eyes and looked hard at Abe, as if waiting to be challenged. But Abe only nodded. Please sit down, he said. Be comfortable. Malka, stop dancing around like that. You're making me dizzy. Malka obediently stopped twirling, but she still bounced a bit in place. David, guess what? There's a lady who lives across the alley from us who, when it's hot, walks around all day in a man's T-shirt and shorts. You can see her when she's in the kitchen. It's really funny. You want to come out on the fire escape and watch? David suddenly looked troubled and stared up at his father. Is it okay, Daddy? He asked. His lower lip trembled. I don't want anybody to get mad at me. Sam took a breath and, with an obvious effort, smiled at his son. It's okay, he said. I'll be right here, keeping an eye on you. Nothing bad will happen. David's face brightened, and he turned to Mawka. Let's go, he said. The two children ran to the window and clambered noisily onto the fire escape. Sam put their suitcase on one of the chairs, opened it, and took out two bottles of wine. Here they are, he said. Certified kosher, according to the man I got it from. You got the $5? Abe handed Sam five crumpled dollars. Here you are, he said, as promised. You want a drink before we start? Sam nodded. Abe picked up one of the bottles, looked at it for a moment, and then shook his head, exasperated. Look at me, the genius, he said. I never thought about a corkscrew. Sam shrugged, took a small pocket knife out of his pocket, cut off the top of the cork, and pushed the rest into the bottle with his thumb. Abe took the bottle and poured generous helpings for both of them. They each took a drink and looked outside, where Mawka and David sat on the edge of the fire escape, her legs dangling over the side, his legs folded. A dirty pigeon fluttered down to the railing and stared at the children, obviously hoping for a stray crumb. When none came, it started to clean itself. David pointed to a window. No, that's not her, said Mawka. That's the man who lives next door to her. He has two dogs, and he's not supposed to have any pets, so he's always yelling at the dogs to stop barking or he'll get kicked out. The children laughed. Startled, the bird flew away. So, said Abe. Yeah, said Sam. What happened? Sam took a breath, drained his glass, and poured another. He had gone out to shoot rabbits, he said slowly. I had just got home from the trenches. We were living with my wife's family in Alabama, and we were making plans to move up north to Chicago, where I could get work and David could get schooled better. He was sitting on the porch reading, and I got mad and told him not to be so lazy, get out there and shoot us some meat for dinner. When he wasn't home by supper, I figured he'd got himself lost. He was always off exploring and forgetting about what he was supposed to do. It looked off into the distance. After dark, the preacher from my wife's church came by and said there had been trouble. A white woman over in the next county had complained that somebody had looked in her window when she was undressed. A lynch mob went out, and David saw them, got scared, and ran. He wasn't doing anything wrong, but he was a Negro boy with a gun, and they caught him, and he choked for a moment, then reached for his glass and swallowed the entire thing at a gulp. Wordlessly, Abe refilled it. My wife and her sister and the other women, they went and took him down and brought him home. They had cut him and burned him, and my boy, my baby. A single tear slowly made its way down Sam's cheek, tracing the path of the scar. My wife and I, we didn't get along so good after that. After a while, I cut and run, came up here. And David, he came with me. For a moment, they just sat. We lived in Odessa, said Abe, and when Sam looked confused, added, that's a city in the Ukraine, near Russia. I moved there with the baby after my wife died. It was 1905, and there was a lot of unrest, strikes, riots, people being shot down in the streets. Many people were angry. And when people get angry, they blame the Jews. He smiled sourly. I and my friends, we were young and strong and rebellious. We were different from the generations before us. We weren't going to sit around like the old men and wait to be slaughtered. I sent Mawka to the synagogue with the other children. There were hiding places there. They would be safe. And I went to help defend our homes. At least you had that, Sam said bitterly. Abe shook his head. We were idiots. We had no idea how many there would be, how organized. Hundreds were hurt and killed. My neighbors, my friends. Somebody hit me. I don't know who or with what. I don't remember what happened after that. He paused. I do remember screaming and shouting all around me, houses burning, but it didn't seem real, didn't seem possible. I ran to the synagogue. I was going to Atmalka, and we would leave this madness, go to America where people were sane and children were safe. Safe, repeated Sam softly. The two men looked at each other with tired recognition. But when I got there, they wouldn't let me in. The rabbi had hidden the children behind the bima, the place where the Torah was kept, but they said I shouldn't see what had been done to her, that she had been... She was only 9 years old. Abe's voice trailed away. The children out on the fire escape had become bored with the neighbors. Do you know how to play rock, paper, scissors? David asked. Here, we have to face each other. Now, there are three ways you can hold your hand. Does she know? Asked Sam. No, said Dave, and I don't have the heart to tell her. David knows, says Sam. At least, I told him. I thought maybe if he knew, he'd be at rest. But I don't think he believed me. And, well, I'm sort of glad, because it means he is still here, with you. Yes, Sam whispered. The two men sat and drank while they watched their murdered children play in the fading sunlight.
That was Barbara Krasnoff reading her short story, Sabbath Wine. This, of course, is Billie Holiday.
Blood on.
don't need to go on to the next cut. Ah, you are tuned to listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio, New York City, WBAI, broadcasting at 99.5 FM. The program is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. And once again, you heard Barbara Krasnoff, K-R-A-S-N-O-F-F, reading her Nebula Award finalist short story, Sabbath Wine, that was published in Clockwork Phoenix 5, edited by Mike Allen, which is available. You can go to Barbara's website, or, well, actually, you can go straight to Mike Allen's website, Mythic Delirium, M-Y-T-H-I-C-D-E, the Delirium, L-I-R-I-U-M.com. And, in fact, Barbara has a new short story just published there. Another cheerful one, like that last one, called The Ladder Back Chair. We have one more movie review, by the way, to come from Dan Persons in a little while, but I didn't want to just do one movie review after another. That'll be Old Man Logan and probably some other things in there. I think he may have reviewed Stalker in there. I hope so. I'll talk about Stalker. Stalker is currently playing in art cinemas in a newly restored 2K version. That means, you know, high resolution version. Although, having rewatched it on streaming media just a few days ago, as a matter of fact, I'm not quite sure how urgent it is that you see it in high def, but it is a good thing to see it on the large screen, and I am very pleased that Andrei Tarkovsky is again getting some recognition. He is, without question, one of the best filmmakers of science fiction fantasy. He's done three. They all start with S's. I mean, he's made many films, but his greatest films are, as far as I am concerned, his greatest science fiction films are Stalker, which is based on a novel by Andrei and Boris Strugatsky, Russian novel, Russian movie. And Stalker, by the way, is, you know, somebody who is looking for things, sort of like, in this case, people who are able to go into an area called the Zone, where at some point, perhaps, some aliens visited, and when they left, things were different. So there's Stalker, and then there's The Sacrifice, and then there is, of course, perhaps Tarkovsky's masterpiece, Solaris, based on the novel by Stanislav Lem. But Stalker is out. It's in theaters now, as a matter of fact, and I do recommend it, or you can find it on streaming media, and re-released, I believe, as part of the Criterion collection. I highly recommend it, as I do Solaris, but it's nice to know there's a new version coming out. Let's see. If you specifically would like to call up and discuss that short story or this year's Nebula Awards, you may do so by giving us a phone call at area code 347-335-0818. I don't want to take too long a period of time. And I didn't actually announce who the other Nebula Award winners were. I will say, by the way, that very often the Toastmasters and all of that can be Well, not as great as other times, but we had a wonderful Toastmaster this year, an astronaut who was a very tall guy, fellow originated from Taiwan, but is an American astronaut nonetheless, and really clever, interesting, and did a fine job presiding. The other Nebula Awards, Grandmaster Award this year went to Jane Yolen, and what was really thrilling was Barbara got to share a table with Jane during the autograph session the night before. The Solstice Award for service to people in science fiction and fantasy went to Peggy Ray Sapienza and Tony Weisskopf, who is still very much with us. And the Kevin O'Donnell Jr. Service Award to CEPHWA itself to Jim Fiskus. The winner, I'm not going to go into all of the nominees. You can look those up, but I recommend them all. For the Andre Norton Award for Young Adult Science Fiction and Fantasy went to Arabella of Mars by David D. Levine. The Ray Bradbury Award for Outstanding Dramatic Presentation went to Arrival, as it darn well should have, because Arrival is one of the best science fiction movies in years, bar none. You want to call up and argue that one? Go ahead. Then, short story, as mentioned earlier, Seasons of Glass and Iron by Amal El Motar. The novelette was The Long Fall Up by William Ledbetter. Novella, Every Heart a Doorway by Sean McGuire. And the winner for the best novel of the year was All the Birds in the Sky. I'm, by the way, going to, I think the word is cavil just a tiny bit, to say I'm very proud that, you know, when I look at novel, 1, 2, 3 of the novelists were on this program in the last year. In novella, 1, 2, 3 again. And I got a chance to meet Victor Laval, so I hope we'll have author of The Ballad of Black Tom, and I hope to have him on shortly. In novelette, let's see. Only one person has been on this show in the last year. Short story, 1, 2, 3. Good enough for now. But we'll improve on those numbers. But that's just a way of letting you know that I wasn't choosing these people on the basis of, oh, I think this is going to be an award-winning story. I simply do because I think they're good and that the people are worthy. But I'm so happy when I see that people who I have brought to the airwaves here on Hour of the Wolf have been recognized by the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America and the Hugo Awards. I'll have to do a comparison on that as well. So let's see. I wanted also to discuss some recent media in science fiction. Next week, by the way, of course, being at the Nebula Awards 2 weeks ago, I did bring my recorder, you better believe it, and spent pretty much all of Thursday and a part of Friday recording interviews with various people. And we're going to hear one of those last week, in fact, with a person who did the presentation of the best short story writer. God, my brain. Andy Duncan. My brain just, like, had a brain bleep, you know, where it's like, huh? Oh, yeah, it's 2:30 in the morning in New York City, or thereabouts, 2:23 at any rate. So, yeah, and yes, I've had a full day, so pardon me for all that. Andy Duncan, I had forgotten how much of a genius Andy really is in discussing the field. So next week on this program, we will hear that interview. It runs about an hour, and we will also hear his almost 1 hour long reading of a short story called Zora and the Zombie, which he read on this program about 11 years ago. So next week on this program, Andy Duncan, and you will be amazed, I promise you. Okay, Wonder Woman. Obviously, when it comes to talking genre cinema, that is, although there's a whole lot to come still this summer, and at least one more Marvel movie. We've already had Guardians of the Galaxy 2, which Dan Persons reviewed earlier. But Wonder Woman is the movie of the summer. There is no question about it. And this is delightful for many reasons. Number one, the fact that the last movie that I liked that was set in the DC Comics universe was probably Batman, directed by Tim Burton. Batman Begins by Chris Nolan was okay. I was not impressed with that trilogy overall. Among other things, I like a little humor in my comic book. It is, after all, a comic. And these movies, the way that they brood and brood and brood is a little bit too much for me. And nothing broods more than the series of films that have been produced, especially in recent years, by Zack Snyder, who has removed himself from future productions, with starting with Justice League of America. For it's just awful. I would rather, as Dan Persons wrote me today, it would be better to have Zack Snyder polluting the DC universe and even the Marvel universe and whatever than have him leave cinema for the reasons he did. But he had to deal with the suicide of a child. And for a while, he decided that he was going to try to immerse himself in work, and maybe that would do it. So, but it didn't. It didn't. So he has, for the time being, retired from movie making, and one can only wish him the best. Now, he had already decided a while back that Wonder Woman was going to be put into the hands of Patty Jenkins. Joss Whedon had had the property for a while, was reportedly paid a great deal of money. Patty Jenkins is a fascinating director. I'm not that familiar with her television. She's done a little. She's only brought one movie to the screen before, and that was Monster, starring Charlize Theron. Not exactly a giggle fest, not a comic book movie, and but nevertheless, an Academy Award nominated and winning one on several grounds. She was going to be the director of Thor, Thor number two, Thor the Dark Underworld, or whatever it is called. It is not a great movie. It is arguably one of the weakest of the current Marvel Cinematic Universe. And she began making the movie, and she realized, between the script and several other things, that this was not going to be a great film. So she left and had it taken over. I don't recall who the final director of Record was, but it was not her. And her thinking was, is that if that becomes the one Marvel movie that is dissed, that is told, okay, that just didn't work, then because she is a woman, she was going to get the blame. They're going to say, you see, women can't be the ones to make these tentpole comic book fantastic universe movies. And so it sounds like that was a very wise choice on her part. And then the Snyders, Mrs. Snyder, I believe, being other person involved, brought her into Wonder Woman. She did not write the script, but she did direct, and she directed it beautifully, brilliantly. She made a movie, with a lot of humor. It is a very funny film, the way a comic book movie ought to be. The first act of the film that takes place in Wonder Woman's island, the paradise in which she lives, is clever and funny, especially when Chris Pine, playing Steve Forrest, crash lands. I had a little of a bon mot as his plane crashed there, and I said, he stitched the Enterprise again? But anyway, there is a scene with him coming out of a bath, and Wonder Woman, who has Diana Prince, who has never, actually at that point, just Princess Diana, has never seen a man before, especially one coming out of a bathtub. And the dialogue in that scene is worthy of naughty dialogue that might have come out of Lee Brackett in The Big Sleep, or there are moments in Rio Bravo where Lee Brackett, where she came up with, you know, some wonderful stuff. The Big Sleep, everybody remembers. Bacall and Bogart talking about, you know, the racehorse and judging each other and things like that. So that's a lot of fun. Then the second act of the film takes place pretty much in London. And there, the fish out of water is Diana, who does not quite ken to World War I London and the society of people and the whole patriarchal notion. She meets secretary within the British Secret Service, asks what her responsibilities are, and she says, oh, where I come from, they call that slavery. Role played by Lucy Davis beautifully, by the way. The performances, the acting are really, really great. David Thewlis playing a sort of a director of MI5 is really very good. Almost as good as he is in Fargo, but that's something else I'll discuss shortly. And then the third act starts getting underway, and I'm afraid where everybody else is raving nonstop about this movie, this is where I will take exception. It becomes what they call in gaming a boss fight. It's no different, you know, the last part of Guardians of the Galaxy is just this half-hour battle against the big bad. And it's the same thing in Wonder Woman as she battles Ares, which is the purpose, actually, that for which she was seemingly made. I suspect there are parts from the first moments from the first part, and for that matter, the second part of the film, that were perhaps dropped and could have been, could have had a little bit more exposition. I don't need a 20, 25-minute battle between two people with, you know, a couple of cutaways. And we know more or less pretty much who is going to win, although there are going to be some twists. And it was just, well, standard comic book fare in a movie that otherwise just stood out so well. Well, it really did. I'm very, very pleased at the result. I am giggling at all of the uproar of males who are unable to accept the idea that a women's comic book movie, and it isn't that, by the way, but it is a film that women can sort of bond over, which is why the Alamo Drafthouse Cinema, the main one in Austin and the one in downtown Brooklyn, as a matter of fact, it's about six blocks away from where I am right now. We're on Atlantic Avenue. It's not far from here. I like going to that theater for many reasons. It's actually gotten me out of my home to see movies again and going there to see films. And the fact that they're doing five entire screens. There are how many screenings of this movie? This is the number one movie running now. So imagine how many screens it's playing on, right? I don't know the number. It's playing on a lot of screens. And then, how many times a day is it playing? Okay? So figure that out. And out of all those times, five in Austin and five in New York are for women only, apparently. At the first one in New York, some men got in and it wasn't a problem. But that there should be such a hullabaloo, a right-wing magazine put on its cover saying, Wonder Woman is propaganda. Well, I mean, that's, though I hate the expression, the pot calling the kettle black, but you know what I mean. It's just freaking absurd. What it does is it breaks some precepts. For some reason, people didn't bother in noticing the movie Lucy, now, which proved that Scarlett Johansson could very easily carry an action film, a comic book style action film on her own. And the same director, Luc Besson, has done this any number of times before, including with La Femme Nikita and so forth. But at least Wonder Woman has a woman director. That is really the main point. It's not just Gal Gadot. And then there's another strike against it, and this is a rather interesting one. The movie has been banned in Lebanon. Yeah, well, they'll say it's because of women in the politics. Wrong. It's because Wonder Woman is played by an Israeli Jew. And they can't cope with that. Racism comes from all over. So, let me just recommend that movie for a good time. It runs 2 hours and 20 minutes. I think it would be a far, far better movie if it ran for 2 hours. And I can tell you exactly where the cuts could be made. And then actually you wanted those extra 20 minutes, put them in the beginning and in the middle. That, you know, gives us a little more exposition. That would be really good. Okay, so that's my review of Wonder Woman. I've no doubt that we'll hear Dan Person's take on it very shortly, but that was my, not even so much a review, just a discussion about it. Let's see, I said I would talk about Fargo. I watched episodes 7 and 8 tonight. Now, I thought actually it was going to be an 8-part show. It's not. It's a 10-part show. And there are, without question, supernatural influences. Not overt, but you watch it and you'll understand what I'm talking about. And Fargo is an absolutely brilliant, fabulous example of a new trend that has been coming along in both cable and streaming media with science fiction and fantasy movies. And that is that they take a universe that has been established, in the case of Fargo, a tongue-in-cheek mystery, or a thriller, rather, intrigue movie, done by the Coen brothers some years back. And they take that universe. And then The Man in the High Castle takes the premise of Philip K. Dick's arguably best novel and makes its own story, completely its own story. It's not following the story of the novel. It's in the universe of the novel. And this, by the way, is something else. That's the point I was going to make about Fargo. It's got nothing to do with the movie, outside a few characters show up. A constant series of nods to the Coen brothers in the episode that was shown on FX last night. There were a number of nods to The Big Lebowski, but it is not a remake of the movie. It's not, the characters do not repeat. There may be, there's one thing that repeats in the first two seasons, and that is the suitcase filled with money. Outside of that, that's it. Then Noah Hawley, who's been making the three seasons of Fargo, who seems to be a bit of a genius also earlier, and I did discuss this on the air earlier, did the TV series Legion, an 8-part series, and I believe there will be a part two. And you wouldn't know, if you weren't a big comic book reader, that this is in fact an X-Men spinoff. And after how many movies taking the work of our friend Chris Claremont and using his work for hire and generally not giving him screen credit for the stories that he's written that were, you know, X-Men 1 and 2 and this Days of Future Past and this film and that film, although he got to play roles in some of them, particularly Days of Future Past, where he's a senator, so at least got paid for that. At least on Legion, he got his name up there. And the way that Noah Hawley handled Legion is absolutely brilliant. He's creating a new form of American serial television, episodic television. And maybe episodic is wrong because they're not so much episodes. You need to see all eight. You need to figure it out. There are new things happening. If you know nothing about X-Men, if you know nothing about who Legion is supposed to be, I'm forgetting the name of his character. Terrence Taylor will hate that because he can go on and on about that character, as can so many people. And Chris Claremont, a fairly frequent guest on this program, who wrote the damn thing and created the character. I apologize to you all, but it's a thrill to see Chris's credit in big, big letters at the end of each episode. But what he is doing with this and the form of television that Noah Hawley is creating is fabulous. Now I'm going to have to deal with this happening to one of my favorite all-time novels, and that is American Gods by Neil Gaiman. And good morning, Lister.
Good
It's been like, you know, years since we've seen each other, isn't it? Well over a month at any rate.
You look younger.
Well, if only. So American Gods, you read the book, take your time. In fact, I recommend read it in paper form or else on two devices so that you can have Neil Gaiman's blog up. He kept the blog while he was writing the novel, and there are so many different gods of myth that are referred to within the book American Gods, that it's a great deal of fun, especially if you're reading the novel for a second, third, or fourth time, to go between, finding out about, Anansi, and then reading of his background as an African figure involving death, but not necessarily darkness in any number of ways. It's great, great stuff. Now, in this case, one of my favorite producers of television, Brian Fuller, is one of the people behind American Gods. This one is showing on Stars. Now, I have not yet seen it because I do not subscribe to Stars. But the first episode has been made relatively freely available through various streaming services, so to try to get people hooked. And while I have not watched it, I clocked in at the very end just to see what it looked like. And it was all blood and gore. It was just, amputated parts of people's bodies. It's a lynching scene is what it is. The cast looks great. The material may be very good. But there is this trend that has, of course, been really brought forth largely by Game of Thrones, no doubt, in which it's like, hey, let's get as much nudity and as much gore. And by gore, I don't mean violence. I mean freaking gore. I mean, get the blood on the screen. Get the show a spear entering somebody's eye and piercing the socket. Let's see arterial spouting and all of this. And I'm sorry, that's not entertainment. That's shock for the sake of shock. So, guess what? I don't watch Game of Thrones. I love George Martin's writing. When he lived in the New York area, I would see him frequently. He's a friend. He's a very good writer. And I'm so pleased that he has found so much success. I cannot watch that show. And I really hope this is not going to be the case with American Gods, since I am simply... As I said, it's one of my favorite novels. And if because and what's notable about these, as opposed to the streaming shows that are on the various streaming channels, this is different than FX. FX is cable TV, but it's commercial cable TV. Run by Gasp Fox, but at least it's Fox Movies, not Fox News. They're not really associated for some unknown reason. The Fox FX channel of entertainment movies is really excellent. I don't know. I feel guilty about it since Fox is anathema to me, but nevertheless, they put out very, very good entertainment stuff. And they're not doing the gore, but the cable channels are. Netflix is not doing the gore. And they're turning out, by the way, some real quality television stuff. Luke Cage was overlong. It was 13 episodes, but it was brilliant. And Jessica Jones, and to a lesser extent, oh, the first one with the blind lawyer that went two seasons. Iron Fist sucked. No two ways about it. One word, two-word review. It sucks. It'll be interesting to see where they go with the Defenders, which is taking those four characters and having them basically fighting between, Hell's Kitchen and Harlem are the places that they are primarily defending within these four shows and with the upcoming series of The Defenders, which I believe starts in a couple of months on Netflix. It'll be very interesting.
The Defenders?
Say what?
The Defenders?
Oh. It's a comic book series that's made into a TV series that's coming up on Netflix. So we will see where they take that, and well, that's neither here nor there. I was talking about American Gods and my great hope that there will not be, you know, all the broodiness and all of the outright gore. Not violence. Violence, you know, I can deal with violence. It's gore that I am against. I won't watch it. It's not entertainment. I don't need the nightmares. I don't mind a shock in a story. I don't mind a gotcha. But I mind gore. And I hope that American Gods will not be that. But I also have a problem sometimes when they take absolutely favorite characters and just kill them off. Sometimes for the sake of killing them off. And with that in mind, we now switch to another recent review for us done during May when we were preempted by Dan Persons, and he's reviewing the film Logan.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. I've mentioned before how I feel that black and white isn't used enough in present-day film. This isn't just a nostalgia thing. I grew up at a time when color film had pretty much taken over commercial releases, and anyway, who wants to see 2001 or Star Wars in black and white? But there are situations, a certain starkness in storytelling, a sculptural use of light in the cinematography, when turning from the Technicolor path enhances the storytelling experience. The story is that director James Mangold took black and white photos on the set of Logan, the final and decidedly best chapter of the Wolverine saga, and so liked what he saw that he pushed for a black and white cut of the film to be struck for the home video release. That just became available last week. I didn't get to the original color film when it was in theaters, but I went out of my way to purchase the Blu-ray set. That's probably going to be my Blu-ray purchase for the year. I stream most of my stuff now. My guess is I really would have liked the color version of the film. In telling a more grounded, near-future tale of a worn and aging Logan attempting to ferry a young mutant girl born from his DNA across the Mexican border while also caring for a senile and quite dangerous Professor X, Mangold recasts the X-Men franchise into a modern-day Western. With a lot of Peckinpah-grade violence, the film earns its R rating, but no shortage of poignance as well. In black and white, though, the film becomes nothing less than stunning. Mangold and his cinematographer John Matheson shot with an eye towards the black and white conversion, and the noir cut complements the more naturalistic story being told, while the overall stylization of black and white functions as a better canvas for the CG effects. You don't feel like you're watching a comic book movie. Instead, Logan Noir connects more directly to the original primal feelings that comic books inspired before comic books became a film genre unto themselves. And those feelings are wonderfully evoked through the recreation of the classic noir look. It worked for Howard Hawks and John Ford. No reason it can't work now. Logan, in any incarnation, is a successful conclusion to a hitherto uninspiring franchise. Logan Noir is one of the best films of the year. I'm finding it hard to sum up the experience of watching Andrei Tarkovsky's 1979 film Stalker, which recently had a re-release in New York in a newly struck print. Part of that is due to how personal the film feels. It is a science fiction story about a stalker, which here is a kind of guide, taking a writer and a professor into a forbidden zone wherein, legend has it, exists a room that can grant your deepest desire. But given the tortured history of the film, a year's worth of footage was lost when the lab botched the processing, and Tarkovsky underwent considerable pressure from his studio over the budget, it is also a rumination on the nature of art, specifically the art of film, and the journey an artist takes in offering up his heart for others' appreciation, despite the risks of having such offers summarily rejected. It is, in a way, the polar opposite of Logan, a ruminative tale largely centered around three men wandering a forest and a couple of abandoned power plants while burying their souls. In other ways, it complements Logan Noir with stark, sepia-toned cinematography of the ravaged world outside the zone, bookending nearly as stark color cinematography within. It is overall beautiful in its ruined environments, occasionally funny, and at the end, surprisingly, deeply moving. That the shooting in some seriously toxic environments likely led to the deaths of a number of crew, including Tarkovsky himself, only enhances the resonance of this tale of a man who risks his life to reveal the mysteries of an unseen world to people who may not appreciate what they behold. Prior to this, the only Tarkovsky film I'd seen was Solaris, and Stalker is very much in the same subtle, profound mold, with the added impact of feeling that the creator is truly, unsparingly offering himself to you. I'm sorry that I couldn't call attention to this sooner while it was still in theaters, but Stalker will be available on Blu-ray in July, and it is worth catching. For Hour of the Wolf, I'm Dan Persons.
Well,
I'm Jane Persons. Movie review.
Why does that keep, you know, I don't have this on repeat play, but it repeats the play, and that wasn't the idea. At any rate, thanks, Dan. I'm glad that he did get to mention Stalker, but I will point out that it is still in theaters right now. At least it was 2 days ago, and I hope that it will continue to do that for a little while. So we are done for the morning, but I've said pretty much all that I have to say, except stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clappers with Lister coming your way in just a couple of moments. And if you would like to get in touch with me, you can do that through the Hour of the Wolf group on Facebook, or you can write me at my own domain, jim@ourwolf.com. That's HOURWOLF.com. And I hope to hear from you next week on this program, an interview with writer Andy Duncan, writer and teacher Andy Duncan, and somebody really has his finger on what makes good writing and what's decent in SF right now. Without necessarily naming names, he talks about the trends and what they are. So, and also we have him reading one of his short stories. So, thank you for listening. Glad to be back on the air after 5 weeks of feels like exile, and hope to be talking to you soon. Take care, everybody. Be good to each other, especially in these times We're going to need it, and we all deserve it. Have a good morning, and have a great week. Take care, and thanks for listening.
Yeah. ship. Let's find the people who hate this. These are the places we'll hit.
Number one,
Panama, talking about Peru, Azania, Brixton, Belfast, can't forget Korea, Beirut, can't forget Haiti, Iran, Puerto Rico, Colombia, Mexico, talking about Uptown, Harlem, New York City, y'all, and Nicaragua, East and South Central LA, California, IA, Miami, do or die, Bed-Stuy, never ran, never will, Brownsville, boogie down, South Bronx, yeah.
My man Joey to jail, and now they got him in court because he burned the flag. That's the name of the game. Well, I quit playing. I doubt the suckers want you to hear what I'm saying about this nation. Freedom supposed to be the format, but I step on your flag like it's a floor mat. Maim and mangle, the star spangle. I'm not trying to diss you. I use the flag like toilet tissue to wipe my black ass. What? You think that I'm a jackass? I see a flag and I attack fast with some fire. My desire to burn what Betty Ross sold up. The truth I show up about America, America, home. The free boom. This is the home of the slave. Now hold on just a mother minute. You gave me freedom of speech in the First Amendment. So why wanna scold me when I touch the flag? I'm only doing what you told me. You don't like it, so what? I'm not scared of you. Your flag, America too. See, I made up this new rule and I want y'all to learn it. Strike a match to the American flag and burn it.
'99 Cinco List Alive, Burn Baby Burn. Yeah, '99 Cinco List Alive, Burn Baby Burn. Yeah. We're gonna play you the number one tune in London, England today, Burn Baby Burn style. David Katz on the case, Don DeBar on the case.
To make Britain, yes, a country that works.
Liar, liar.
Not for the privileged and not
fire,
for the
fire, fire.
But for every one of us.
Burn Baby Burn. '99 Cinco.
We, the Conservative Party, can build a better
Britain. Burn, baby, burn. List Alive, WBAI.
She's a liar, liar.
Yeah.
She's a liar, liar.
Uh-huh.
No, you can't trust her.
Brand new.
No, 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 no.
Lick it this time.
She's a liar, liar. She's a liar, liar. No, you can't trust her. No, 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 no. We all know politicians like telling lies. Big ones, little ones, porcupines. Saying they're strong and stable, won't disguise. We're still being taken for a ride. The nurses going hungry, schools in decline. I don't recognize this broken country of mine. They're having a laugh, let's show them the door. Then cut the rich, not the poor.
I've been very clear that I think we need that period of time, that stability, to be able to deal with the issues that the country is facing. I'm not going to be calling a snap election.
When I leave, you bring the mask.
She's a liar, liar. She's a liar, liar. No, you can't trust her. No, 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 no.
When I leave, you bring the mask.
She's a liar, liar. She's a liar, liar. No, you can't trust her. No, 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 no. I want to have a government that doesn't think that fascism is where it's at. Cause putting the mother of all bombs into tiny hands can go very wrong. I'm hoping for a future for my child where she can grow and feel inspired. Do everything in your power you can. People rising up is the only plan.
When future generations look back at this time, they will judge us not only by the decision that we made, but by what we made of that
99
decision.
Cinco, first I'm on the air in Imperialist
USA. That we shaped them
USA.
A brighter future.
Burn, baby, burn.
they will know that we built them a better Britain.
She's a liar, liar. She's a liar.
Melista, produce Melista, mix Melista.
Generations look back at this time. They will judge us not only by the decision that we made, but by what we made of that decision. They will see that we shaped them a brighter future. They will know that we built them a better Britain.
She's a liar, liar. She's a liar, liar. You
gotta say, she looks nice. I gotta say that she looks good in that new dress. She's just about perfect makeup, perfect nails, and you can't afford a car. Everything's good, but she forgot to pay her. Sparkles in her eyes. Say she looks nice with her brand new hairstyle. I gotta say that she looks good in that new dress. She just bought perfect makeup, perfect nails, and you can't afford a car. Everything's good, but she forgot to put sparkles in her eyes. In her eyes.
Oh.